Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Does the Environment Matter? In association with the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Ed Dobb, feature writer for National Geographic and a teacher at UC Graduate School of Journalism. Ed will be our moderator and introduce our panel tonight.
Thank you, Anne, and welcome. It's wonderful to see a full house. I guess we sold out, which we didn't expect, and we're very pleased by. I want to quickly apologize to anyone who was lured into the Commonwealth tent by the unofficial title for tonight, which was Sex, Death, and Climate Change. We won't be talking about sex or death. Hopefully, nor will we be saying much about climate as such. But I'm confident that we can mount a lively and illuminating discussion, and you will go away feeling you've spent your time well by coming here tonight. We're gathered here because in recent years there's been a sea change in American media, one consequence of which is a sharp decrease in the resources that are dedicated to covering environmental stories and environmental issues, especially in the traditional media. So we're going to explore the future, the fate of environmental journalism. What are the perils ahead? Where's the promise? Where are the opportunities? What can we learn from the past? What lays ahead for the prospect of covering the environment in an effective way? So we'll be exploring that. Looking at the panel tonight, I see friends, for one thing, which is a joy. But I also see a great deal of talent, accomplishment, and experience. But for the sake of time, I'm going to make the introductions very brief. I'm going to ask each of our panelists to do a quick opening presentation, and then we'll move on to a group discussion followed by an audience Q&A, as Anne said. So first up is Mark Dowie, who is a dear friend. He's co-founder and former publisher and editor of Mother Jones. He's currently publisher of the Point Reyes Light, which is the newspaper up in Point Reyes Station. He's also he's a very busy guy. He's got a lot going. He's also, these days, he's the creator, executive producer, and host of Talking Points Radio. So, Mark, if you would grace us with your opening remarks. Thank you.
Thanks, Ed. So everybody you see up on this panel here cut their journalistic teeth and developed their careers as environmental reporters. And all of them did so in an era when the environment was almost always on the front page of American media and always on the evening news, the broadcast media. It was a major, major beat in journalism. And for reasons that baffle us and others, it's kind of slipped off the front page and the environment. Although the issues haven't gotten any less dire and any less important. I have two theories about why this happened. The first one is our fault. I think that from 1970 to the turn of the millennium, we offered up a lot of content that kind of frightened our readers, depressed our readers. The coverage of the environment was largely, although not exclusively, negative. And I think if I was going to, during that time, I edited a national magazine, And if I were going to do it over again, I would say that a fifth, about 20% of our coverage should be positive. There is good news in the environment. There always has been. And I think that where we failed, our editors and ourselves, we failed during the heyday of environmental journalism was in, I would say, negative reporting and to the expense of positive reporting. Not that there isn't serious and dire problems. I would say 80% of the environmental problems are news stories are negative and dire, but they have to be balanced. The other thing, of course, was just world events. They're unavoidable. A friend of ours who we all know on this panel, Marla Cohn, who was a environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times, tells a story about herself on 9/11. 2001, she was standing in the newsroom of the Los Angeles Times watching the World Trade collapse, and she looked down and shook her head and said, "I'll never be on the front page again." Now, that's a sweet story, but it was prescient, and she's pretty much discovered that was true, and we all have. And I've often said that a major event could put us back, put the environment back on the front page. And one of the things I've said was that a storm that wipes out half the cottages on the East Coast could do the trick. And Sandy almost did that. And it really did bring the environment back into higher relief, at least higher than it had been for a while. And I just hate to think that it's going to be catastrophe that drives journalism and media again. But it tends to be, and if that's what it takes, that's what it takes. I should say just before I pass the mic to my peers that environmental journalism, unlike almost any other beat, requires an enormous amount of specialization, sophistication in science, the law, an understanding of movement activism, regulation, government regulation, and public policy. It is a very, very difficult and sophisticated beat. And it's a shame to me to see people develop themselves as really, really superb journalists like these people here and then have the beat be discredited or disrespected or moved to a secondary position by the leaders of American media.
Okay, Mark. Thank you. Next up is Jane Kay. Jane is a former environmental reporter for both the San Francisco Examiner and the San Francisco Chronicle. She's currently a freelance journalist. She's lived through the transition. She's embodies a good part of it, both good and bad. And she's been working for two online publications, Environmental Health News and The Daily Climate. Jane?
Thanks. My leaving the Chronicle was part of a general industry upheaval in 2009. And one of the websites tracked loss of jobs, and I think it was like nearly 21,000 journalism jobs were lost in 2008 and 2009. And at the top 100 largest newspapers in the U.S., I think it was 6,300 jobs in 2008 only. So we've lost a lot in journalism, not just in environmental reporting. And in my case, I started writing immediately for Environmental Health News and the Daily Climate, and they're two independent foundation-funded sites. And the good thing about them is that their editors are former newspaper people, and so we have the same standards of our ethics, accuracy, fairness, honesty, all the things that journalists strive for. And it's Environmental Health News is an aggregator, so every morning you can see stories in English from around the world that are selected, but it also commissions original stories, and that's what I do. So they just want enterprise stories, and that's enterprise stories are great to write online because they can be longer. I mean, you can be writing 3,500 words and not 1,000 words or 500 words that you might get in print. And one of the downsides of leaving traditional journalism is the loss of the newsroom, because we forget that an office or a newsroom is like this pod of knowledge. And just being there, you are hearing from all these intelligent people around you what they're reading, all their discussions about great stories, laughing at hideous errors that other people make, when knocking on wood that you don't make them, you know, sharing shocking ethics violations. And so you absorb the law, the what the press is, the whole honor of the Fourth Estate. And so as a freelancer, and I see this with other journalists who have left traditional jobs and are now going freelance, they clump together. We clump together in these like little groups, and we share job tips, how to solve technology problems, gossip about who's working where. And the groups such as the Society of Professional Journalists, the Society for Environmental Journalists, and, you know, the union, the freelance unit of the Pacific Media Workers Guild, all these have become more important because they're carrying this veil of tradition that and knowledge that we need to pass along to the young journalists who are coming up. And isolation is not good for writers, unless you're J.D. Salinger, of course.
Okay. All right, Jane, thank you. Next, we will have Paul Rogers. Paul is the environment writer at the San Jose Mercury News, and we're all mystified by that because we've been talking about how these jobs disappeared. He not only has it, but he's had it for 17 or 18 years. But he's also managing editor of KQED's Science Unit, a multi-platform science and environmental site or project. Paul.
Thanks, Ed. It's great to be here, and thanks for everybody's interest. We have a bit of a clunky internet connection, so when it comes back, I'll show you the KQED site that I work on. But what everyone's saying, I agree with so far. I would ask everybody, when you think about the diminishment, the erosion of environmental journalism, it's not because editors somewhere in a powerful suite say, we don't want as much environmental journalism. I think it's actually part of a much broader problem, and that's the collapse of the newspaper business model that worked for 150 years in this country. There were three ways that newspapers made money. They sold subscriptions, they sold help wanted ads, and they sold display ads, you know, to department stores and movies and things like that. The internet has absolutely destroyed all three of those categories. Help wanted ads, which used to provide about 40% of the revenues of newspapers like the Chronicle and the Mercury, were obliterated by Craigslist and eBay, which frankly are better, more efficient ways to sell things to people. You get more lines, you get photographs. It's a better product than three lines in a newspaper for $50. So that entire category of revenue went away. Online, we have not been able to figure out how to sell people newspapers online. It started off free. It's still free. Whenever people try to put up paywalls, nearly all papers except for the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times have failed at it because they can't get enough people to click. And so they actually make more money by selling ads and getting more clicks for free and telling the advertisers more people are looking at the ads. The last category is the display ads. Those have gone places like Facebook and Google and lots of other places online. So you think about it. The newspapers just don't cover as many beats in general as they used to. The coverage in state capitals is much smaller. Book sections, I'm sure you remember reading book sections. Those are gone. Religion writers, a lot of things that people cared about have shrunk. The number of journalists working in newsrooms in the United States has fallen 30% since the year 2000. It's at the lowest level since 1978. And the reason for that is that the total revenue for print advertising has fallen 55% since 2005. Think of any business that you work for or government agency where you lose half of your revenue in 7 years. What would happen to the staff? So what we're going to talk about here today are different models so that we can continue to cover important environmental stories so that journalism, which is the only business mentioned in the Bill of Rights, can continue to flourish. We're at an important transition period where we're trying to figure out how to make money still so we can pay journalists, how to keep the doors open, and how to grow it in the future. And a lot of that involves social media. It involves, you know, mobile devices. It involves different business models like public media where you have memberships, that kind of stuff. So we're in this really important historical time, and I'm optimistic that we're going to figure out a way to get through to the other side because an informed public is a better America.
Thanks, Paul. And that'll segue nicely into James Fawn's presentation. He is executive director of a new way of going about this sort of thing, an outfit called Earth Journalism Network, which is a project of Internews. He is a former journalist, environmental journalist in Southeast Asia, Thailand, and he founded the Thai Society of Environmental Journalists. So, James, could you?
Thank you, Ed. Thanks for having us here, and thanks to all of you for coming. Yeah, so if I were going to talk a little bit about what's going on overseas, I think the picture is a little bit different there. In fact, in many countries around the world now, especially in the rapidly growing industrializing countries, the media is actually still expanding. You, in fact, have new newspapers opening up in countries like India and Indonesia. Indonesia itself is undergoing a veritable boom in TV networks. There are new ones opening up all the time. And, of course, all this media, and this is happening with the expansion of the middle class. The middle class wants more not just entertainment but also more news. So there is space to fill that content gap with news about the environment and science and other issues that can really help inform the public. So when I joined with this group, Internews, about 9 years ago, I'm not sure if you're not familiar with Internews, we're a media development organization. So we work with local media groups around the world to help them improve their news coverage, their coverage of important issues. We are not a news agency ourselves. We work with local media and local journalists. So my job in setting up the Earth Journalism Network was to help improve the quantity and quality of environmental coverage. Let's try and fill all this new media that's opening up with more content about the environment, about science, about public health, about issues that, you know, can really help the public improve their lives, the quality of their lives. And so today we now have a membership of 4,500 journalists around the world who are dedicated to covering environmental issues. We work with them as many of them as we can. We provide a lot of training. We do a lot of online activities. We connect them through listservs. We try and bring them to important conferences like the climate summits so they can cover it and get access to the negotiators, which otherwise they would not be able to report on. And the other thing we do is we help set up these local networks of environmental journalists. Jane mentioned the Society of Environmental Journalists. That's a really useful organization for journalists, especially in the U.S., too. Just because when you form a group, I mean, first of all, you've got a lot of peer-to-peer learning, so you've got the senior journalists training the younger ones. But you also have strength in numbers, you know. And when I, as an individual journalist, would try and get the Thai Minister of Industry to come and explain why oil companies are dumping mercury in the Gulf of Thailand, he would ignore me. But when a whole group of us, representing much of the country's media, made that request, well, you better believe he came and talked to us. So what we do now is we try and work with these local networks of environmental journalists around the world, or we set them up where they don't exist in countries like Indonesia and the Philippines, Mexico. And these organizations then become local institutions to help journalists in those countries cover the environment with both international and local support.
Okay, James, well, we've got you. Could you briefly tell us how Internews and Earth Journalism Network is funded?
Sure. So we are funded through nonprofit means. We're a nonprofit organization. We get most of our funding these days from private foundations here in the U.S. We also get funding from some European governments. And I'm happy to name the foundations. There's the Packard Foundation here in the Bay Area. There's Marisla Foundation, Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And we're very grateful for their support. We also get funding from some European governments like the Swedish government, the UK Department for International Development. And I think we just got news that we just got our first grant from the U.S. government, actually, today. So that's very interesting to hear.
This takes, and I'd like to throw this open to the panel as a whole, anybody who wants to weigh in. If it weren't for nonprofits right now, which have been willing to pony up for various experiments, there's a lot of things that we, there would be a lot more that we would lose or wouldn't have right now. As the traditional media backed off on funding investigative journalism, for instance, we saw the birth of projects like ProPublica or the Center for Investigative Reporting. And I'm just wondering if the panel thinks that that gap that's also was also created in environmental journalism has been similarly filled by the nonprofits or other experimental models.
Well, I'd just like to say first, as a former investigative reporter, that there was actually a sound economic reason for cutting back on investigative reporting, given the fact that the model that that Paul described was failing. Investigative reporting is line for line about five times more expensive than any other form of reporting. It's just incredibly, it's time consuming, it's expensive, and when editors looked at their budget, it was harder and harder for them to fit investigative reporting in. I'm on the board now of two or three investigative organizations, nonprofits, and I look at the product of most of them, and I look at what is finding its way from the nonprofits that are producing investigated material that is turning up in mass media, I'm pleased. I think the material is better than it was when investigative reporting was taking place inside the institutions, and investigative reporters had to fight with other reporters in the institutions and editors who didn't care as much about, and publishers whose friends were being investigated and stuff. So this is all stopped now, and so it's a, I'd like to see the same thing happen, and I think it is happening to a degree with environmental reporting, where institutions like GRIST and the institutions that that Jane works for are expanding, and more good environmental material is coming out of that. Whether or not it finds its way into mass media doesn't matter that much to me, as long as it finds its way into the eyes and ears of the American media consuming public one way or another, whether it's through aggregates other means.
Anyone else?
I think there are a lot of good web-only media companies that have popped up. It's an issue of capacity. You know, unless you have a big multi-million-dollar donor like ProPublica, it's really hard to make a go of it. The Bay Citizen, we saw, was an attempt at that in the Bay Area, and it didn't really work. And again, you need to be able to sell enough ads online with the traditional business model to pay a bunch of reporters and to pay the lawyers to do the good investigative reporting like Mark is talking about. You need to be able to sue people in the government when they won't give you records. It's very expensive. And so, one model, let me make a quick point, actually. Those types of organizations, which were looked at as sort of fringe organizations a few years ago by traditional journalists, are now really coming into their own. There was an organization, Inside Climate News, which won the Pulitzer last year for their reporting on pipeline spills, in particular the Enbridge pipeline spill up in Michigan, which was a tar sands type spill. They have 7 employees, and they're a web-only company based in Brooklyn, and they beat out people like the New York Times. There are other web-only companies that have won a lot of awards. The problem is to get sustained, consistent coverage, you need a lot of people. You know, when the Chronicle and the Examiner merged 15 years ago, there were 600 newsroom employees there, and now there's 150. Think about that. The Mercury News, we've had similar declines in our numbers, but we still have more people, even in a diminished state, than a lot of the startups and web companies. So I think they play a really important role, particularly on the investigative in-depth stuff like Jane does and like Mark's talking about, in terms of the day-to-day beat coverage of agencies and the Coastal Commission meetings and all that kind of stuff. You just need a lot of bodies to do that, and that's one of the places that we're really falling short right now.
Paul, you were talking earlier before we started about the KQED model, the member model. And could you address that a little bit?
Sure. 7 years ago, with a grant from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, KQED decided to try to go deeper on its science and environment coverage. And we created a show that I was managing editor of called Quest, which some of you might have seen on television. We have a weekly radio show also. That has since grown. We've gotten money from National Science Foundation. We've gotten money from viewers like you. Thank you very much. I'm sure a lot of you here. And it's a different business model. We don't depend on classified ads at NPR and PBS. And there are 900 NPR stations in America, 300 PBS stations. I'm really optimistic about them becoming one of the places that can fill the void, because they don't rely on that business model that's broken. They have other ways of getting money, a little bit from the government, but mostly from members and foundations. And, you know, we have built the largest science and environmental staff in the state of California just in the last 7 years at KQED. We cover on radio, on the web. We make e-books for classrooms on everything from earthquakes to, bioengineering to all sorts of science topics. We make half-an-hour TV specials. We have a half-an-hour special coming up on Lake Tahoe, October 16th. Another half-hour coming up right after that on the commercialization of space and the big new era we're in space. So I'm pretty optimistic that as traditional media is still finding its way, public media, if it wants to, can step into that void.
I think we all realize that the important task is convincing people that they have to pay for news. Somehow because we gave it away for free, they think they don't have to pay for it. And if you want reporters around the world covering what's going on, you've got to have the money to send them there and keep them there. And so I think what the New York Times is doing, you know, making people pay for digital news, other newspapers are doing it, this is going to happen. Or people are going to have to donate just as they give to KQED. They're going to have to give to news agencies as a public service to keep it going. They have to realize that they just can't get it for free.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California and our program, Does the Environment Matter? In association with the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, with Ed Dobb, our moderator, and our distinguished panel members, Mark Dowie, Jane Kay, Paul Rogers, and James Fawn.
Let's switch gears a little bit, and I'd like to talk for a little while about, we've talked about some innovations, some experiments, new models, business models, and that sort of thing, but let's try to get, if there are any more that we should get out on the table that you think are promising. James, you've got a couple of thoughts, I know.
Yeah, well, there are different kinds of innovation. First of all, there's innovation, the types of journalism, maybe we can talk about that later, in data journalism. But in terms of funding, I think one thing we're going to be exploring, based on the trends that Paul and Jane were talking about, how, you know, we need people to start paying for journalism, how can we find a way to actually get people to pay for specific stories? Maybe that is a way to, you know, if consumers of news we're asking them to pay, well, they probably want more control or more say over the what is being reported. And these days we're seeing a lot more of crowdfunding initiatives, right? Kickstarter, organizations like that. So one idea we have is we would like to explore the possibility of linking together individual journalists or news organizations with specific stories and the public or other donors who want to fund those kinds of stories and see if maybe we can put them together so that you have direct funding of specific stories or specific news organizations on environmental topics. And we don't know if this is going to work, but I think it's worth trying.
Any others?
Well, you know, when we were starting the Center for Investigative Reporting, we had this exercise where we used to say, let's start with the word investigative as an adjective and see if we can figure out different ways to communicate investigated material than just through reporting. And so, you know, and it would get a little silly after a while because we'd start talking about investigative satire and investigative poetry. And we went through every different way of possibly communicating in investigated material. Well, I think environment needs to do the same thing. Reporting is not the only way to communicate environmental issues, environmental problems, and environmental sensibilities. Media, in the broadest sense of the word, is not just the press. Media is everything that is all information that is transmitted, whether it's transmitted through broadcast, print, poetry, legitimate theater, movies, whatever. It's much, much bigger than the press, although the press often forgets that. I think that environmental communication needs to go through that exercise of thinking about every single possible way to communicate in environmental information, environmental issues and environmental problems, and environmental solutions.
Let's continue this just a little bit longer about innovation and promising experiments that are going on. And James, you mentioned type of journalism, but also if any of you see any new sites or projects out there or on the horizon, let's bring them into the discussion too.
Yeah, so one of the things I wanted to talk about is data journalism. This may be a phrase you've heard about. These days, especially in the developed world, but really all over the world, there's a big flood of information, of data, on environmental topics that is being made increasingly available to the public, satellite data, all kinds of data, geophysical data. And if we can somehow turn this data into actual stories that people could understand and learn from, that could be a real boon to journalism. So we've been working on, for instance, this platform in South America called Info Amazonia. And what it does is it takes all kinds of data about what's going on in the Amazon. There's deforestation data. There's data on fire. You can see the different layers listed here on mining projects, on protected areas and indigenous lands. And we map it all. We visualize the data so you can easily see what's happening, often in a time sequential basis. On top of that, we have a network of journalists on the ground in the Amazon and we post their stories, and you can see each of these tags on the map. We overlay their stories on top of the data so you can provide narrative context to the stories. This is a new kind of journalism. We call it geojournalism, and it requires new kinds of skills from journalists. It requires data analysis skills. You need to understand what the data is saying and how to present it. It also requires curating skills, how to aggregate these stories in some kind of meaningful way. But it's proven to be quite popular. We've gotten lots of hits, and about half our audience is in Brazil, about a quarter in the U.S., and other audience in around Latin America and Europe. And we think this is a new kind of journalism that can help, you know, bring new kinds of information to the public and hopefully expose them to more news about the environment.
How do we, in this brave new world of digital journalism, especially with respect to environmental stories, how do we ensure quality, consistency, accuracy, thoroughness, independence, some of the values that we aspire to under the old regime?
We don't, because we're not in charge anymore. It used to be journalism was about scarcity, right? Only a few rich people had a printing press. Only a few rich people had a television transmitter. Only a few rich people could get an FCC license and have a radio station. With the internet, everybody has a printing press. Anybody can set up a blog. Some people's blogs get more hits than newspapers. Matt Drudge gets more hits every day by himself than the Washington Post. You know, whether that's a good or bad thing, I'm not going to say, but he gets a lot of hits. The same with podcasts. You're your own radio station. The same with television. YouTube is a television network. People make their own television shows, put them up on YouTube all the time, and we have no control over what they put out. And that's been very difficult for a lot of traditional journalists to accept, which is that we are not Walter Cronkite on Mount Olympus telling you at our time that's the way it was, and you only have three places to come and listen to us. You get the news on what you want, where you want, how you want. And media companies that don't realize that and don't get the news to people in the different ways that people want the news, or don't allow them to comment on the news or to become part of it, they are becoming irrelevant. And a lot of newspapers have already gone out of business. A lot of big newspaper companies are bankrupt. So the loss of scarcity is an incredible, you know, journalists like to grumble about it, but it's an incredibly democratic thing, if you think about it, that anybody, any place in the world, in any country, can communicate with the rest of the world. And, you know, one thing that journalists are starting to realize is social media, Facebook, Twitter, Google+, those things are really a better way to bring people to your websites, to bring eyeballs onto the website so you can go tell the car dealer or the movie theater how many people are looking at your site, and you can charge more money for those ads. People are coming in these side doors much more than they are going to the website. Not as many people go to a website, you know, MainStreetNewspaper.com, as see a story on Facebook that their friend recommended, or see something on Twitter and go in sideways. I think the number at the KQED Science site is something like 80% of the people come from other places. They don't type up KQED Science. And the number one referrer is often Facebook. So journalists need to become very adept at social media, because that's another way to communicate with the audience where you want, where they want, how they want, when they want. And there's going to be a lot of junk out there. There's no question. But that's the – right? James Madison was about the marketplace of ideas. If someone puts up a bad idea, you put up another idea. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, that leads perfectly into what I was going to say, because I think that new media is wonderful. I think that social media is wonderful. It's fun, and it's informative, and it's very, very useful. The problem is that probably 80% of the people who are practicing – and contributing to social media are not trained journalists. And so that the tenets of sound journalism are being lost, I think, a little bit by the expansion of new media. Now, the school that Eddie and I and Jane taught at, the University of California Graduate School of Journalism, and it, was one of the first schools to realize that new media was a legitimate form of communication, and that people who practice new media and contribute to new media really should understand and be held to the same tenets of journalism as Paul Rogers is at the Mercury News. And the school is training people who go directly into new media, which I think is a good thing. But I look at some of these reports and aggregates, articles that are on some of these things, and I read them, and I think, Jesus, these people need to go to school or just take one course in basic journalism. It's sad, and it really is important. I mean, I'm politically a very radical person, but I'm very conservative about my profession. I think that journalism has to be abided by very, very carefully and very religiously.
You know, there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, when people didn't go to journalism school. They learned in the newsroom or like I did. I worked in the magazine field from the get-go, and I learned editing and writing through mentorship relationships with other editors. I was part of a culture, you know, part of a team. Jane, that's a concern of yours, obviously, from your earlier remarks and some things we've talked about. Do you see it's problematic in terms of not only the quality of journalism, right, but the stories that are covered or not covered? Do you think we're missing some things?
Well, it is a concern because, you know, no one can argue that it's great to break down the gates and let everybody write. But new media doesn't mean bad media. And, you know, when we talk about citizen journalists, I mean, would you want like a citizen surgeon, like taking out your gallbladder? I mean, you know.
I think I know that guy.
Yeah.
I'm suing him.
Right. And so people who go to the news want to be able to trust it. Why else would they waste their time reading a story if they didn't think it was fact-checked, grammatical, viewed by editors, weighed? Is it really a story? You know, before we write something, we take so much time in trying to evaluate, is this really a story? Is this right? And if it's a story, how do we find the best sources in the world, people who are not corrupt, who are not, you know, inaccurate? I mean, all of this is pretty difficult. And so we are left in this new world without the umbrella, you know, news desk that we used to have at hundreds of newspapers around the country. You know, we don't really have this anymore. And so that is what that's what he's trying to develop. Training your new journalists, and they don't have to be, you know, at universities, but they have to know these skills. And what I was saying before about Society of Environmental Journalists, Society of Professional Journalists, taking on these roles of teaching.
One thing, and this intersects at least a couple of you, again, Paul, with KQED Science Environment Unit. It's a multi-platform. It's storytelling via all media, including radio. And then Mark has launched his own radio program, and I'm curious what any of you might have to say about the future of radio, this old-school medium that seems to be very popular. Mark, you want to?
Well, radio is the fastest growing medium. Audio is the fastest growing media in the press media spectrum. And more than half of the material that is produced as audio journalism is never actually broadcast over the traditional airwaves. That doesn't mean that people aren't seeing it. It's going over the internet, it's going by satellite, it's going through other ways other than the FCC airwaves. So, and probably most of what I produce never reaches the airwaves. I syndicate through PR, my material through PRX. Half the time I don't know who's picking it up unless I check with PRX, but small stations pick it up. But also podcasters pick it up and remarket it, or it's really, really hard to follow. It's also hard to make money doing what I'm doing. I've invested way more than I'll ever get back out of it. But I guess at my age I can afford to do things for fun, which is what I'm doing. But I do believe that radio is – I've always been a radio person. I'm a pre-TV baby, and I listened to radio before I consumed any other media. So I love the medium. But I think there's a big future in radio.
Paul, where does the radio fit into your approach?
One thing that we've noticed at KQED that I think is kind of interesting is as newspapers have diminished and their capacities to cover news in the Bay Area has diminished, KQED, which has been around for more than 50 years, decided to try to cover more news and to step it up. To fill in that gap. And so a couple of years ago, the board of directors invested more money in doing news at KQED. So whereas before we were doing something like five spots a day, these are the little 2 and 3 minute news toppers at the top of the hour and the bottom of the hour. Now we do about 18. And what we've noticed is as we did more news, a little more traffic, a little more sports scores occasionally in there, the weather mixed in with all the other stuff we do, the basics that people want when they're in their car, the ratings really started to grow. And KQED for the last 2 years has been the number one station in the Bay Area in terms of listeners. It's past KGO. It's past KCBS, which is astounding to me. It's the only market in the United States where the NPR station is the number one station. And what that shows to me is that there are people out there who really want quality news. A fair number are willing to pay for it. There's 140,000 members. And so, you know, quality can sell. I don't think that people are ever in large numbers going to pay to read text stories online. There's a lot of papers that have experimented and a lot of have stopped. I mean, the Chronicle, just this year, they put up a paywall. 4 months later, they took it down. And, you know, a lot of other papers have done that, too. There are special cases like the Wall Street Journal where people, you know, they can write it off as a business expense, or the New York Times, which is, the best paper in the country. But, you know, I've always thought that the NPR stations, these 900 stations, have the potential to be the next Associated Press if they wanted to. They have more boots on the ground than any other news gathering operation. They have more people than the Associated Press. They're spread out in every town in America. And if they could really coordinate well at different levels, it's like 900 bureaus, and they can write tech stories. They can feed some nationally to NPR. You know, probably half the radio stories we do, the features that run on Monday mornings, run nationally on NPR. I tell people that's 30 million listeners. You know, when you watch Anderson Cooper, he has 2 million viewers. People get worked up about Bill O'Reilly. He has 3. NPR has 30. So, you know, there are lots of people out there who like quality journalism. I'd also just finish the point by saying there's still we shouldn't forget there's still a lot, despite the diminished capacity of newspapers, there's a lot of really good environmental journalism that's getting coverage. I urge you to look at the Seattle Times. They did a wonderful project this weekend about acidification of the oceans. Craig Welch, he's a friend of mine.
That was
amazing. And they have beautiful, and I'll pull it up on the screen here in a minute. They have beautiful graphics. He was in New Guinea. He was looking at crabs in Alaska. He was all over the place. The LA Times has a 1A story this morning on Lake Tahoe. The Chronicle, over the last couple days, had a front page story about the Build-A-Ban lead bullets, about the effort to remove or to reduce cars in Muir Woods. The lead story today in the Chronicle on the front page is about air pollution and people who live near highways. I've written a bunch of stories in the past month that have gotten on the front of the Mercury News about, you know, wetland restoration in Napa and the Rim Fire and all sorts of other stuff. So those of us who are still out there in the trenches slogging away, you know, the editors will still put good stories on the front. It's just that we don't have as many people doing it as we did before.
James, did you have something to say about this?
Well, on the one hand, I would say not everyone who logs onto the Internet or goes to read a newspaper is necessarily looking for news. Some of them are looking to reaffirm their worldview. And so I think that explains the popularity of some what we might call questionable news sources. But I think in addition to all the excellent things that my colleagues have said, The other thing we should be thinking about is kind of the other side is media literacy. I think we don't only need to teach, you know, journalists or people who are writing stories about proper journalism ethics and techniques, but also we need the public needs to understand when is a story, you know, legitimate? What is the value of a good source? You know, how can you tell a story that has been, you know, professionally developed from a story that really is just trying to, you know, stoke emotions or to get you to think a certain way? And we're starting to see more of these media literacy programs, and I think that's going to be really important in the future.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio, and our program, Does the Environment Matter?, in association with the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. We've come to that part of our program now for the audience to share their questions with us. And so for those of you who would like to ask a question, I'm going to start at the back and work forward. Just raise your hand. We do have a limited time, so if you don't get to ask your question, the panel will be here, and they'll be welcome to the questions that you have. So somebody raise their hand back here. And remember to speak into the mic.
Hi, my name is Mary Catherine. I'm a reporter covering this for Yale Forum on Climate Change. One thing I hear a lot from newspapers when they disband environmental desks is that they are just spreading out the knowledge to other departments, and that the end game is to not have an environmental desk, that everyone would be adept enough at covering the environment. I'm wondering if you can just share your thoughts on that notion. Are we 100 years before that's possible? Do you think that that's the end game, or will there always need to be a dedicated environmental desk? Thanks.
There's a great debate over that among environmental reporters. Some people have worried that when environment writers have their own little unit, sometimes it's easier to sort of say, oh, well, those are just the advocates over there in the corner. They're not real journalists. And that's been something that environmental journalists have grappled with for decades. People got really worked up when the New York Times disbanded their environment desk earlier this year. I actually think what happened was they were cutting back for the same reasons I've talked about earlier, and they had a couple of editors and 9 reporters. They didn't fire any of the 9 reporters. The 9 reporters spread out to other desks, and they were able to get rid of 2 editors. It, to me, was that simple. It was basically an accounting gimmick, and people got worked up on one side. The Times said, oh, no, it's part of a big plan to make sure we have people in the business desk and the national desk. I thought they were just trying to get rid of 2 bodies to help reduce the staff. Other people may have other views, but it's a debate that we're having, and most media companies don't have the luxury of having more than 1 environment reporter to have on a desk to spread around anyway. So it's only sort of moot at the really big papers.
Hi. So I have a pretty basic question, which is, do you think that the environment really does matter? And if so, I mean, not to be facetious, but, and if so, do you think that we, based on your collective and enormous experience, do you think we have to reach people on a personal level, or can we address more, you know, the so-called commons?
I think that the answer to that question depends largely on what you mean by the environment. I mean, it's still an ill-defined term, really. But if you mean it in the broadest sense of the word, not just, you know, the things that urban people care about, but the broadest sense of the word, yeah, of course it matters. It always will. I mean, life depends on a healthy environment, all life, not just human life. So, yeah, it matters, and it always will.
Yeah, I just add, I hope I'm speaking for my colleagues when I'm saying it, that's why we're in this business. We do think it matters. And I would just add that we do need to reach out to other audiences that may not necessarily turn to our coverage. And so, for instance, this is one of the reasons in developing data journalism portals, we set up something called Climate Commons for here in the U.S. And this is a very simple site. It was, you know, quickly put together. But what it does is it takes stories about climate change from all over the country, and it tags them and puts them on a map of the U.S. alongside data, the latest data about climate-related issues, weather, precipitation, And so for this, the goal of this kind of project is that for you to for audiences to understand how climate change is affecting them here and now in their home towns, regions, states, because a lot of what people get through the general news is, you know, broad abstract stories about climate change. But if we can make people understand how climate change is affecting them today, here and now, then perhaps they'll take it more seriously.
Hi, my name is Missy, and we just finished a 60-minute documentary called The Future of Energy. And we were crowdfunded through an Indiegogo campaign. And I'm wondering if you would speak to documentary films and if there's room for them and how you see them spreading, if you do.
Yes, we like documentary films at KQED. We air them, we make them. We think they're a really important part of the whole media puzzle. You know, we've aired lots of environmental films, a David Brower film. We aired the four-part Saving the Bay series, which Robert Redford narrated, which won an Emmy. As I mentioned, I've just finished working with the staff there on a half an hour about Lake Tahoe. Can we save it? So I think the work that folks like you do is really important. And I always feel for documentary filmmakers. I think they have one of the hardest jobs in all media because it's really hard, as you know, to raise the money you need. And often they max out their credit cards, and it's hard to get people to watch these films. And you have a short window of time where you strike when the iron's hot. And some of them really take off, you know, films like Gasland. And then a lot of really good films don't take off. And I think it's a very hard job, and I really admire the people who toil at it. So good luck with The Future of Energy, which she has cards here for if anybody's interested.
As someone who makes about half his income writing narration for documentary films, I do believe that documentary films are very important. That said, there's an awful lot of terrible documentary films made nowadays. Really, really terrible.
My perception is I come to a lot of these kinds of talks, and my perception is that you're preaching to the choir a lot, and what you don't do is tell the people how they individually can help solve. Because you're telling them what's wrong, but you're not telling them what each one can do, and have you done this, and are you counted, and are you influencing your neighbors, and are they influencing the community? You're not getting that message out there. It's not in your articles. You're telling us what's wrong. We know what's wrong. You need to get to a tipping point where the public gets it, gets enthused about it, and takes off with changing their paradigm. Our paradigm doesn't work anymore. That message is not getting out there. We're a nation of spoiled brats, and you have to change that paradigm. That's why you have problems with climate change, and you're not addressing. Is this man driving an electric car or not? And if he's not, why not?
It's up to him.
I understand that, but that's not leadership.
Well, my job isn't to make him drive an electric car. That's the Sierra Club's job. And I love electric cars, by the way.
And incidentally, it's the Sierra Club that's preaching to the choir, their own members. I mean, they're saying exactly what their members want to hear. I don't think that anyone in this panel is preaching to the choir. We're putting out stuff that the choir doesn't want to hear often, all too often, and they're telling us that in many, many different ways every day.
I would say, actually, in agreement with you on some stuff, a lot of times we don't tell people where they can go to do things. You get one story a year on the coastal cleanup, by the way, which is next Saturday, 9 a.m. Everybody show up. You'll read about something. You think someone's interesting. You want to follow up. There often aren't links. There aren't phone numbers. And I think a lot of journalists traditionally have been reticent to put that in there because it feels to them like advocacy, right? Some of this stuff is not that clear. Some people think nuclear power is a solution to climate change. Some don't. So what do we tell you to do there? Some people think genetically engineered food is a way to feed the world. Some don't. What do we tell you to do there? Right? So that's part of the discussion that we're thinking of when we write these stories.
Hi, my name is Kathy Howard. I'm with an organization called SF Ocean Edge. And for the last 4 years, we've been trying to protect the western end of Golden Gate Park from over 7 acres of artificial turf and 150,000 watts of stadium lighting that are going to be installed. We have had a little bit of luck with some local papers, but not with some of the major papers who started out in favor of the project from the beginning and were not willing to print our point of view at all. So my question is, you folks sound great. How do we reach you? How can we contact you? How can we interest you in our story and in protecting the habitat and parkland? Thank you.
All of us get, when we're working, get a lot of press releases from organizations that have really, really worthy missions like yours. The problem is we get too many. I mean, there's just a stack on our desk. And what tends to grab our attention is the creative, unusual, innovative one with a compelling narrative attached to it, or that we can be steered to. I'm throwing it back to you. It's in your ability as a communicator, or as your communication consultant's ability.